This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Warning. If you are already feeling depressed, this may not be the program for you. Maybe you should take a walk outside instead. For those still listening, according to one of the world's biggest oil companies, their primary product may not be around for much longer than 50 years. In this program, a senior scientist follows that logic to find a catastrophic crash of our economy and world population is very, very likely. We'll follow up with a chat with one of Canada's top climate scientists. He says we don't need more science, we need action to save ourselves. So he ran for the Green Party and got elected. Speaking of politics, Catholic legislators in the U.S. Congress say they will boycott the Pope's speech there because of his views on global warming. Let's go to our favorite source, the father of all that's right, former President Ronald Reagan.
Preservation of our environment is not a liberal or conservative challenge. It's common sense. Let us be sure that those who come after will say of us in our time, we did everything that could be done.
Australia's great climate denier and coal lover Prime Minister Tony Abbott just got the boot from his own party. His replacement is at least on record acknowledging that climate change is real and dangerous. One more to go. Canada's tar sands Prime Minister Stephen Harper is up for election in October, with polls showing him running dead last in public opinion. Of course, the political theater may be all far too late. Pop a few antidepressants for our next guest as Radio EcoShock rolls on into the dystopic future.
Radio EcoShock.
In about 50 years, oil and gas will run out. But our bubble of economic growth and increasing population will crash before that. It has to. That's according to our next guest, Dr. James H. Brown. He's a distinguished professor of biology at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Dr. Brown, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
To grasp the big picture for humanity, let's start with just one of your intriguing concepts. What is the Earth Space Battery?
The Earth Space Battery is this idea. It's a way of thinking about the energetics of the Earth and the energy that's used by all life on Earth, including humans. And this battery has gradually accumulated over hundreds of millions of years as living organisms harvested energy from the sun in the form of photosynthesis and incorporated that energy into their bodies. And so one of the two components of the battery is living biomass, which is now mostly the living material that is tied up in the trees of forests worldwide. And then as those organisms died and became fossilized, they produced the second component of the battery, which is fossil fuels. That is the reserves of oil, gas, and coal that we've used to fuel the modern what we call the modern industrial, technological, and informational economy.
What are the signs that this giant planetary battery is running out?
There are two signs. One is that we have increasingly good data that the living biomass component of the battery has been running out since at least the birth of Christ, and more rapidly in the last century or two, as humans have had a bigger and bigger impact on ecosystems around the world. And that's through deforestation, overgrazing, paving, production of toxins. Humans have reduced the total quantity of living biomass on the Earth by about 50% of what was before modern agricultural humans appeared on the scene about 10,000 years ago. And that depletion has accelerated very rapidly in, as I said, the last 100 to 200 years. And then the other, in some ways more serious, potentially more serious depletion of the battery is the exhaustion of fossil fuels. those reserves of oil, gas, and coal are finite. It took hundreds of millions of years to build them up. And in just a little over a century, we have used up on the order of about half of those reserves. And the rate at which we're burning through the rest is very rapid. So as you mentioned in the lead-in, British Petroleum recently has suggested that the economically exploitable reserves of both oil and natural gas will be exhausted in a bit over 50 years from now.
That's amazing. You know, I found that so hard to believe. I asked you for your sources, and here it is, British Petroleum and Oil Company. They're going to be out of business as far as profitable oil and gas in about 50 years. That's amazing.
It is. it sure is. And, you know, British BP has had its problems with the oil spill in the Gulf and so forth. I think it's generally recognized in the industry that they have some of the best science and perhaps the most accurate estimates of reserves, rates of exploitation, and so on. So those are probably the best numbers that exist for us to get a handle on the depletion of this critical part of the battery.
Now, I have some trouble with your argument that economic growth has already stalled due to scarcity, whether it's energy or other resources like copper or iron. It seems to me we're swimming in excess oil right now with prices dropping and other commodity prices are also crashing, maybe partly because Chinese demand has fallen. Jim, how can you cite scarcity as a driver of a global recession during a period of apparent abundance?
Well, let me first qualify this by saying that I'm not an economist. And the flip side of it is that hardly any economists are very schooled in environmental science and the biophysics that you need to understand the role of resources in the economy. But let me make a bit of an analogy and see if this helps. I don't think that anybody would doubt that energy, food energy, is required for a human being to live, right? We have to eat in order to live. And if we're going to grow, we have to eat more because we not only have to support the body that exists at the time, but we have to grow that body. And so we have to consume more energy in order to do that growth. And in a similar way, we would suggest that energy limits the economy and limits economic growth. But humans aren't always consuming more energy. If a human being gets sick and is less active and so forth, the rate of food consumption goes down. And I think, I mean, it's much more complicated than that, but we're seeing something not terribly different from that right now in the global economy. The economy, since the crash of 2008, has been sick. And it may have recovered a little bit in the U.S., but globally, it has not recovered at all. So the economy is sick. It's consuming less resources. And there are a bunch of complicated things about the way that the oil-producing companies and nations had built their productive capacity to meet anticipated demand, which has been less because of the lack of growth in the global economy. But there's still no doubt but what we absolutely require, that energy from fossil fuels to support the present level of human population and the present level of economic development. And if we're going to have substantial additional economic development, there's going to have to be increased energy consumption. And one can see that, for example, in the case of China, which up until a couple years ago was averaging more than 10% per year growth in GDP, and it had about the highest rate of increase in use of energy, fossil fuel energy, and other resources, which are also necessary for the modern economy, like metals, rare earths, and so on.
All right. Now, another contentious issue for some people anyway. About 5 years ago, there was a strong argument that peak oil would hit civilization faster and harder than the slow-moving climate change. And then we got fracking and deep water drilling, but climate impacts have been stronger and faster than anyone thought possible. Where do you see your work in this discussion?
Well, I don't want to minimize the seriousness of climate change. I think there's no doubt, but what, you know, the science behind that is very solid. Climate change is ongoing, and if we don't slow or really turn it around, it's going to cause enormous problems for the Earth and for humans. But, you know, if you look at the kinds of projections that are made with respect to climate change, in part because it is so hard to slow down, a lot of the experts are talking about what the climate is going to be like in 2100, right? Which is, that's 85 years from now. And if British Petroleum is correct, we're going to run out of oil and gas well before that. And the seriousness of exhaustion of oil and gas, I think, cannot be overestimated. I think most people don't appreciate it, but it's incredibly important. I can go on if you like and provide just one example that I think people will fairly rapidly appreciate. We now have 7.3 roughly billion people on the Earth, and the human population is growing. The UN is making projections to the effect that they expect us at present rates to have 9 to 10 billion people by 2050 and maybe 11 billion by 2100. And where does the food come from that supports that population? And we've just recently dug into a number of online databases and other sources. And again, the best numbers that we can get suggest that about 15% of global energy use goes into the food supply system. That this is not just agriculture in the narrow sense, but it includes transportation and preservation and marketing and all of those things. But to keep the current population of the Earth alive, we're devoting about 15% of total current energy use to this food supply system. Now, the bad news, the really bad news, is that somewhere on the order of 80% of that global energy use comes from fossil fuels. And much of the energy that is required by this food system effectively requires fossil fuels. You cannot easily substitute renewable energy from like wind or solar, which produces electricity, for the fossil fuels, because you need that diesel oil or gasoline to fuel machinery, to run the factories that produce the pesticides and fertilizers, to run the transport system that takes the stuff to market, etc. So if, as the BP data suggest, we're going to run out of fossil fuels, we're going to be unable to continue to supply the food needs of a large part of the Earth's population.
So in a presentation, and this is sort of part of what you were just talking about, in a presentation this summer to the Ecological Society of America, one of your slides says, quote, "A catastrophic crash appears inevitable." Do you think other scientists are also reaching that conclusion?
Well, I would say this. Let me put it in a little historical perspective. Some scientists have been saying this for a very long time. People like M. King Hibbard, who came up with the concept of peak oil, and Buckminster Fuller, people back in the 60s and 70s started talking about this energy depletion. Paul Ehrlich and Meadows et al. In the Club of Rome, in their work on limits to growth, warned us about this in the 1970s. So this problem, and the fact that a number of really excellent scientists have recognized it and warned us about it, has been there for a long time. I think it's true now that a small but growing minority of scientists, and I would call them environmental scientists in sort of the very big picture, and this includes everything from physicists to climate scientists and ecologists, this, a small but growing minority recognizes the seriousness of this problem. And then you get, you know, the situation that these things are all interlinked. So climate change, to the extent that humans are causing most of it, is caused by burning fossil fuels and emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. As long as we continue to burn fossil fuels at a high rate, we'll be continuing to add to that and exacerbate the problem of climate change. But on the other hand, when we run out, the addition of CO2 to the atmosphere should be drastically reduced. And although it'll take a long time to get that CO2 out, the exhaustion of fossil fuels should put the Earth's climate on a trend back to some sort of a more normal historic trajectory.
Well, my understanding is that if we burn all the oil and gas, we will have started such a huge wave of climate change that it would take at least centuries and probably millennia before any natural process could bring that CO2 back down. So this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Professor Emeritus of Biology and Head of the Brown Lab at the University of New Mexico, Dr. James H. Brown. Is it possible for the most populous Asian countries to live as Western people do? And if they succeed, what does that mean for the trajectory towards a major systems crash that we've been talking about?
Okay, so this gets back to this issue that the economy is powered ultimately by energy, and it is the use of energy to do work and use that work to create the goods and services that economists talk about that lies at the heart of this. So one of the consequences of that, which we've shown in a couple of our papers and other people have similar data, is that there's a very nice statistical relationship between per capita GDP and per capita energy use. And from this relationship, you can actually estimate how much increase in energy use would be required by a country, let's say, to achieve a certain level of economic growth measured as increase in GDP. And we've made some of those calculations, and again, the numbers are very sobering. For example, for China to continue its economic growth and attain a standard of living for all of its people, an average standard of living equivalent to the U.S., we estimate that China still needs to increase its energy consumption about threefold. And China is now, I think it just passed the U.S. last year as the country with the highest rate of energy use in the world. For the people in the poorest developing countries, we're talking about on the order of tenfold increases in energy use to get them up to the standard of living that we enjoy here in the U.S. or Western Europe, Japan, or Australia. So then if we go back to the BP numbers on available energy, that's just going to be impossible. There's not enough fossil fuel out there to achieve these kinds of goals. And for that reason, we've argued that this widely bandied idea of sustainable development is an oxymoron. It is biophysically impossible.
Now, listeners, we're working around a new paper where James Brown is the lead author, and it's titled Human Domination of the Biosphere, Rapid Discharge of the Earth Space Battery Foretells the Future of Mankind. And it wasn't just published anywhere. It's in the prestigious journal, published August 4th, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS. And in that abstract for the paper, we find this scary little sentence. With the rapid depletion of this chemical energy, the Earth is shifting back towards the inhospitable equilibrium of outer space, with fundamental ramifications for the biosphere and humanity. Jim Brown, can we lose a habitable Earth, or are we just going to find this planet harder and more uncomfortable to live on?
Well, that requires the ability to foresee the future that I think really none of us have. You know, I mean, if you ask what's in store, here is my assessment that what we have created and what we're sitting on or in right now in 2015 is this, what we call a bubble of population and economy. We've grown the global world population and the global economy to a level that is completely unsustainable. And that bubble, or those two bubbles, are inevitably destined to deflate. Now, you know, there are a number of possibilities then. You know, the most optimistic scenario would be that that deflation can occur gradually and in a managed way that will result in a minimum of human suffering. The alternative, unfortunately, is that there's going to be some kind of catastrophic crash. And I would just add to that, and people portray me as a harbinger of doom and gloom, but I think this is reality. This is a world that we have created, that we're sitting on, and that we're leaving to our children and grandchildren. The reality is that some kind of catastrophic crash is very, very likely. And as I said before, we're by no means the only people who have looked carefully into this, the only scientists who look carefully into it and think so. And it's likely to come relatively soon. My own estimates are on the order of decades. Now, that said, the actual thing that sets this off may not be directly the depletion of energy and the depletion of the battery. It could be a global pandemic or increasingly a spread of social unrest and war. It could even be a real crash in the global economy that then compromises the capacity to recover from that and to get back to exploiting the reserves of energy and metals and so forth that built the economy and are required to sustain it. Now, I don't see anything in these scenarios, however, that suggests that all life on Earth is going to go extinct or even that our own species will go extinct. I think this bubble of population and economy will crash, but I suspect that humans will survive, at least some places. You know, they're in some ways insulated some of the biggest impacts of the global system. Humans will survive, and so will a substantial amount of biodiversity and ecosystems. And in fact, then presumably the Earth will likely start to recover from this insult that modern humans have inflicted on it. We've said, and I think this is, you know, true, it's almost necessarily true, that the only real steady state for humanity with respect to global energetics is for humans to be in a balance between net primary production, which is photosynthesis, and consumption. And the last time we had such a rough balance was perhaps 10,000 years ago or so, where we had humans living as hunters, gatherers, and some sort of low-level horticulturalists. But before the major rise of intensified agriculture and industry. So we're talking about reduction of the population, you know, who knows, maybe from, you know, the present 7.3 billion to what, maybe 73 million might be a reasonable guess. I don't think anybody really knows, and there are huge error bars around that. But that would be a 100-fold reduction in population.
Wow, it's pretty hard to hear this. Do you have any advice on how we can digest this awful news?
Well, I guess the one thing I can say is that the longer we wait, the greater the probability, I would say inevitability, that not only that the crash is going to occur, but that it'll be more devastating. So one of the things that distresses me, being a grandparent, is the seeming lack of awareness of the vast majority of my fellow humans, including many of my scientific colleagues, and just this blithe unawareness of what a precarious situation the Earth and civilization is in at the moment.
We've been talking with the distinguished professor of biology, James H. Brown, from the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Brown is the lead author of the new paper titled Human Domination of the Biosphere, Rapid Discharge of the Earth Space Battery Foretells the Future of Humankind. Find that in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jim Brown, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. You can find more links for the work of James H. Brown in my Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info.
Industrial form. The age of people might not be too long as we blunder beyond our norms. The Anthropocene. The Anthropocene. It's all out of balance. Endless growth. Social dysfunction. The Anthropocene. The will to dominate. Wrong turn in the emergence of a flawed human nature.
That was a clip from Dana Pearson's song, Age of Humans. Find all of Dana's work as Vast Man on SoundClick.com. I don't agree with everything Dr. Brown said in our interview. For example, he claims renewables cannot replace fossil fuels for cars and factories. But they can, although our lifestyles and expectations would have to change drastically. But certainly, if oil that is economical to get out of the ground runs out in 50 years, we're in for a crash, if not an age of crashes. We've had a lot of guests say that on Radio EcoShock. Maybe it's true.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Let's keep going with a climate scientist who quit science, at least for now, to become a political activist. Is climate change unstoppable, even if we drastically cut back emissions? Are these mega changes on our planet irreversible? Our guest, Dr. Andrew Weaver, is one of Canada's top climate scientists, most recently with the University of Victoria in Canada. He's been a lead author in many reports for the Intergovernmental Panel on the Climate Change, IPCC, including the 2007 report that won the Nobel Prize. Dr. Weaver was a lead author for the Working Group 1 contribution to the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, and that was published in 2013. The title was Long-Term Climate Change, Projections, Commitments, and Irreversibility. Andrew Weaver, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, in the past couple of years, I'm seeing more statements by official scientific bodies saying some aspect of global warming is now unstoppable or irreversible. NASA says the melting of the Totten Glacier Complex in Antarctica is unstoppable. The most recent 2014 climate report of the American Meteorological Association says warming of the oceans is unstoppable. Do you agree?
There's, you know, the question is, what is meant by unstoppable? There's certainly, because of the inertia in our socioeconomic systems, a large amount of climate change still in store as a consequence of the building we put in place. The question then becomes, what do we want to stop? Not everything, you know, this is not the whole, you know, turn into Venus is not going to happen. The question that we have to ask as a society is, what do we deem to be acceptable or not acceptable? Frankly, you know, there are certain things that are going to happen regardless of the decisions we make today, but there's a lot of things that we can avoid if we actually take steps now to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions.
What about a blue ocean event, the near total melting of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean? Would you say that's inevitable?
I think most climate scientists would argue that essentially, the Arctic will go ice-free in the summer, and that's just going to happen. That is a consequence of what we have done and a consequence of this inertia in our socioeconomic system. So, yes, I think it is inevitable that the Arctic will be ice-free in the summer this century.
Do you think that melting of the permafrost during this century and the following centuries has reached that state of unstoppable?
You know, there is a large amount of permafrost. As formally, what happens is the active layer deepens. And what do I mean by that is the seasonal freeze-thaw element of the top component of the soils deepens. And so what happens when that occurs, of course, is more organic material is exposed to oxygen, or if there's water on top, no oxygen, but it can still decay and produce greenhouse gases. So yes, there is a positive feedback that comes from that, and yes, it will continue for centuries, but there is a finite amount of carbon available in our permafrost, and so it's not, you know, on the scale of what will occur if we continue to burn our coal reserves, for example.
Well, what about the Arctic methane problem and the clathrates, as they're called, under the sea? Could emissions from the permafrost and these methane emissions create more greenhouse gases than humans currently do?
I would say no. Unequivocally no on the permafrost carbon. Simply, you know, when you think about it, what is coal? It is millions and millions of years of sunlight converted to stored energy. Permafrost is not coal. It's essentially organic material that's frozen. So there is not anywhere near as much organic material, carbon dioxide potential in our permafrost for decomposition. Now, the clathrate problem, much has been made of that. I would argue that, in fact, it's been overstated. A couple of things happen as you warm. Number one is sea levels rise. And when sea levels rise, pressure increases deeper down. So the destabilization of clathrates can occur through two ways. One is through reduction of pressure, and the second is through warming. But when you actually increase the pressure, that's a stabilizing effect. So we've done some calculations on this, and I would suggest that the overall warming potential of the methane clathrates is not as large as some have said, because of the fact that they are deep down and they are very stable. Now, on the other hand, if we had vast quantities of ice on land, that would expose many of these continental shelf areas, and therein would be a potential source of the methane.
So are there other geophysical or natural processes developing out of the climate shift that you think are unstoppable now?
Well, it's pretty clear that oceans will continue to acidify for many, many decades to come. And now the reason why I say that is the only big sink for the atmospheric carbon dioxide that we've put in when we've disrupted the equilibrium of the natural system is the ocean. And as the oceans take up carbon dioxide, they become more acidic. And as they become more acidic, it makes it more difficult for those creatures that use calcium carbonate to make their shells to actually form their shells. They can become rubbery, et cetera. So we should start to see substantial impacts there, particularly on coral systems, shellfish, pteropods, things like that. There's also significant non-trivial probabilities that we are close to or will become very close to the threshold for the irreversibility of a collapse of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice shelves. Now, that doesn't happen overnight. It takes centuries for them to go away. But as we warm the world, we actually start to commit us to sea level rise down the road, and that's irreversible. Again, the question is, how much warming are we prepared to? Are we prepared to have 12 meters of sea level rise spread over centuries to come? Are we prepared to not have that? These are the questions that we should be answering, because unless we start to mitigate our greenhouse gases, the inevitability, the probability that we'll get that 12 meters of sea level rise, regardless of what we do, increases very rapidly. It's not about 50% now, but it's likely going to get that to that level in the decades ahead if we don't actually take steps to cut our greenhouse gases.
So I suppose the essential question is, will the Earth continue to warm no matter what path humans take?
There will be some warming in store regardless of the paths that we take. However, the question of how much we want to warm is directly related to how much more we put up. We know from the scientific community can say that the amount of warming is related to the cumulative total emissions. So we know, we can quantify, if we as a society accept 3 degrees warming, we can quantify how much more carbon we can put into the atmosphere and keep it below 3 degrees with a certain probability. We can do the same with 2, we can do the same with 4, or 5 or 6. But, so the question then becomes, what do we as society deem to be an acceptable level of warming? International policymakers have claimed 2 degrees. Now, there's no scientific magical reason for 2 as opposed to 2.1, 1.9, 2.6, or 1.5. However, we can quantify the amount of carbon we can put into the atmosphere and remain below that with a reasonable probability. And that would suggest that we need to turn the corner now, not later, in order to start reducing emissions today. So it's never about, is it too late? The question is always, how much more warming are we okay with? Frankly, I think we need to start cutting emissions now, and that would be my view.
I'm worried that if the public hears from scientists that warming will continue and that it's unstoppable, that they will ask themselves, is there any point to making expensive changes to our energy system or wrenching changes to our lifestyles? What are we going to be able to prevent by acting to reduce greenhouse gas emissions now?
Well, therein lies the $64 million question. The question is this: do we, the present generation, owe anything to future generations in terms of the quality of the environment that they inherit? Because ultimately, that is the overarching question for global warming. If the answer is no, then this problem is irrelevant. If people do not believe that we owe anything to the future, then global warming is irrelevant, because the decisions being made today are not going to affect those who make the decisions, but will play out on the next generation. However, I would argue that most people believe that we do owe something to future generations. Many of us have children, and we want to leave the world a little better place than when we came in. So if that is the case, then we must act now in terms of greenhouse gas reductions. And yes, we can affect the future through the decisions we make today. So it is never too late. It's like eating something bad for you. You can keep eating something bad for you, but at some point you can say, you know what, I'm going to stop. And whatever the cumulative effect of what you've eaten will be there from all you've eaten in the past, but you can prevent further damage down the road. And that's the same thing with the climate system. It's never too late to prevent future climate change above what is already in the cards.
Scientists, Dr. Weaver, have painted a frightening picture of massive changes to our climate, sea level, agriculture, weather extremes, extinctions even, if we proceed along the higher emissions pathway. Do you think the talks in Paris this winter can accomplish enough to prevent that?
To be honest, I think that our international leaders have essentially abdicated their responsibility, and the Conference of Party meetings have been a colossal failure. They've been a failure because people are always thinking more about the short-term consequences of their decisions, their re-election. They're thinking more about the immediate kickback of a decision today and not thinking about the long-term consequences. In my view, we do not need more aspirational reduction targets. What we need is on-the-ground policy. And in my view, this meeting upcoming in Paris will be filled with motherhood statements about this and that. It will be filled about commitments to reducing emissions down the road. But what is needed, the number one policy that is needed globally, is an international price on carbon. If the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, Conference of Parties were to agree on a mechanism to have an international price on carbon, then I think we would start to actually see steps and actions come into place. That would allow each international jurisdiction to actually determine how they're going to implement that price on carbon within their economies. But there is a global price, because until such time as we put a price on things that we put in the atmosphere, because there are costs to it, but we're not paying them, we will not get a handle on this problem. So, you know, frankly, my hopes aren't high. Frankly, I think that what we need is a refocus of these UNFCCC meetings away from, you know, gabbing about what we'll do in years to come. You know, what does it mean when we have G8 leaders talking about zero emissions 100 years from now? What does that mean? It's meaningless. None of them are going to be around to be held accountable to their actions. What we need is decisions today and people held accountable for their actions today, not 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
What do you think of President Obama's recent plan to reduce fossil fuel emissions from U.S. power plants?
You know, Obama has quietly gone on his way, and U.S. will meet its target, this 2020 target. Obama has recognized that there is an economic opportunity to transitioning from high carbon to low carbon systems. And it is a shame that Canada has not seen this. British Columbia, for example, used to be a leader in the innovative technologies that were being put in place as the alternates to the fossil fuel technologies, the so-called 21st century economy. But unfortunately, we've gone the way of the laggards now here in BC as well. So I think Obama is, despite the fact you don't hear him publicly talking about climate this, climate that, quietly on their way, they've been reducing emissions substantively, and they will continue to do so. China's also turning the corner. Of course, I don't need to talk about Europe because they've met their Kyoto target and more. But it really requires all of us to play this game, this emissions reduction game. And it is one that everybody's a winner for.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Dr. Andrew Weaver, a top Canadian climate scientist. Well, the IPCC, and you've been a part of that, uses three major representative concentration pathways. They call them RCP 2.6, 4.5, 6.0, and 8.5. Actually, that's four pathways. And what do those numbers represent? What pathway are we on currently?
Those numbers, the actual number at the end of the RCP, whether it's 2.6, 4.5, 6, represents formally watts per meter squared warming because of human release of greenhouse gases at the year 2100. But that means nothing to anyone. Essentially what it is under a variety of socioeconomic, technological, energy use, et cetera, assumptions, the social science community, working together with the natural science community, have put together a number of trajectories of greenhouse gas emissions into the future that lead to warming of 2.6, 4.5, 6 watts per meter squared, et cetera, by the year 2100. Let's turn that into carbon dioxide. So what does that mean? The RCP 4.5, for example, that's essentially saying that by the year 2100, we'll get to carbon dioxide levels about 650 parts per million. That's about a little over double pre-industrial values. The 8.5 says we'd have carbon dioxide levels of the order of 1,370 parts per million. That's more like four times, a little higher than pre-industrial times. So an RCP 2.6 says we stabilize at 490, and frankly, that requires negative emissions because we're already well up towards that goal, because the CO2 here is CO2 equivalent, including all the greenhouse gases we put up. So we're currently following the RCP 8.5 trajectory, which is not a good thing, because the 8.5 trajectory leads to a rather substantive warming during the course of this century. The reason why, of course, we start to see this warming accelerate is that as we start to recognize issues of air quality, we start to remove particulate matter. And as you remove particulate matter, you start to reduce a cooling effect and the warming gets amplified. So that's the policy we're on. I don't think we should be there. We should be on the 2.6 or 4.5 at worst. And we should start to actually have steps put in place to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as we move forward.
Several scientists, including Dr. Kevin Anderson of the Tyndall Center, have complained that the two lower pathways, which may or may not limit our warming to less than 2 degrees C, explicitly assume humans will develop some geoengineering technology which will remove carbon dioxide from the air and store it somewhere. Is that true?
That's certainly true for 2.6. Now, when people say geoengineering, you have to realize there's two types of geoengineering. There's solar radiation management, which frankly is scary stuff. That's where you mess about with how much sunlight comes to the Earth system. And then there's carbon dioxide removal. Now, we have the biggest carbon dioxide removal around are the oceans and the trees. Trees remove it through photosynthesis. The ocean removes it through uptake. The talks for geoengineering in that respect are, in essence, trying to find ways of capture carbon and store it below the ground. Now, I believe that we will be going down that path in some ways, and I'm less concerned about so-called negative emissions because, frankly, we know what the problem is. The problem is we've been putting the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so we know that if we take that out, we're in essence taking back the pollution that we put in the first place. Less of a problem with that. It's well mixed. But solar radiation management is not something I think society should be even thinking about because we have no idea what we're doing in that regard.
Do we have a technology to suck CO2 out of the air that could work in an amount significant enough to delay or reverse global warming?
Yes, there are technologies out there. David Keith, you know, at Harvard, formerly University of California, Calgary, Prof, has developed sequestration technologies that are able to take carbon out of the atmosphere. My recollection is if we start to price carbon in the $150 a ton range, it starts to become economical to do that. So, you know, it's not a question of can we remove the carbon. It's a question of do we have the will to do so, and are we willing to transition our economies from high emitting to low emitting carbon dioxide economies? And I think the answer is yes, but we just need the political leadership to do so.
What motivated you, Dr. Weaver, to move from pure science to becoming a politician in British Columbia, Canada?
That's a great question. You know, I spent my life working in the area of atmospheric science, ocean science, and the physics thereof. And then in the 1990s, I started to move into looking at climate science and Earth interaction and the climate system. And I was involved in the second assessment report in 1995, involved in every assessment report after that. I've advised local governments, provincial governments, national governments, international governments on the issue of climate science. And I've given numerous talks to schools. I've given numerous talks to the public. And in those talks, I would end up, you know, I would outline the problem, and I'd end up essentially saying, you know, scientists have done their job. Now it's time for politicians to do theirs. And I would say, before the youth, if I was speaking in schools, I'd say, you know, let's take a look at youth voter turnout. There is, you know, 30 to 40% of youth voting. Yet they're the generation that will inherit the consequences of decisions being made by my generation. So if you want to change it, get out and vote for change. And invariably, I get people in the audience say things like, well, they're all the same, and there's no one to vote for. And I would say, well, get out and run yourself or find someone to run. And, you know, there's only so many times you can talk to youth in schools, in public lectures, et cetera, and say that before you take a look in the mirror and say, you know what, I've been doing this for a long time, and it's time for me to put up or shut up. And so I thought, I'm going to run because British Columbia used to be a leader in this area. We had, under the previous Liberal government, when Gordon Campbell was premier, a variety of policies put in place, quite a number of them, not one, not two, but a whole slew of them. And we started to spur that new industry, the clean tech sector. Emissions per capita were dropping, and then we lost it. And we have the present government, which is repealing past legislation. The cap and trade is now gone in D.C., and they're actually going all in on LNG. And I couldn't stand by and watch. So I put myself down to run, and I ran on one where I said, I'm not here to become a career politician like so many of these other people are. I'm here because I believe in evidence-based decision-making. I believe that we need to discuss issues honestly, transparently, and openly, and not play politics all the time. And lo and behold, in what was probably one of the most conservative ridings in the province of British Columbia, I got elected with a party that had never elected anyone before, the BC Green Party. And I thought, you know, when that happened, I thought, you know what? People are ready for change. They're ready for honest discussion. They're ready for change. And I just hope that there are more and more people like me who haven't spent a career doing politics, but really care about the future we leave our children in terms of the economic stability, the long-term financial well-being of our province, in terms of the environment that they inherit, and in terms of the social systems that are there to protect us in case of need. So, and it is only this one party that allowed me to do that, because it's a party that's not going to tell me what to think, but it's going to encourage me to represent my constituents in a way that I believe is.
So look, like many climate scientists, you were attacked personally just for your work, and you sued several journalists and a major Canadian newspaper for libel. You won that suit in February of this year. Is that over, or have they filed an appeal of the judgment?
It's not over. They filed an appeal, and so now we have to just wait for the appeal system to go through. But, you know, I was very pleased by the judgment. The facts laid out by the justice, the judge, were so compelling that I, you know, felt vindicated. It was a wonderful day when that judgment came through. It was the National Post, of course, and three of their editorial page editors. And so I wait for the process to play out. So the appeal will happen probably within the year, and we'll see where that goes.
Let's get back to the science as we sort of wrap up. Now, in 2013, in the report that you worked on, you wrote about changes in atmospheric circulation. How do you see this affecting the weather systems that impact our daily lives?
Well, the climate, you know, I could summarize the entire 2013 IPCC report in one kind of pithy statement: more of the same with greater certainty. So what I'm going to say here, the community has really been saying for quite some time, but the certainty is going up. And the reason why is because we've had more years of data, you know, more and more evidence that it's occurring, that the changes are above anything that can be explained by background natural variability. So what do we expect? We expect more extreme precipitation. In the winter particularly, we expect, and we see that, we expect increased likelihood of summer drought. And we see that. We expect the likelihood of it coming as rain instead of snow going up. And we see that. We look for increased heat extremes. And we see that. We would expect to see more and more warm records being broken than cold records being broken. And we see that. We would expect to see reduced snowpack. And we see it. We expect to see melting ice glaciers. And we see it. So on and on and on, the kind of extreme weather events that have been projected to occur, and scientists have been talking about for, I don't know, as long as I've been doing this, since the 1990s, we're starting to see them. But forest fires, there's another example. There's clear evidence that the amount of area burnt in Canada is detectable and attributable to human activity because of increased greenhouse gases. And we're seeing another year this year. And, you know, it's not going to happen every year. You know, as we have the warming trend, there's variability about it. But you would expect that, you know, the records that were set in temperature this year will be broken in a few years. And we may break a couple of cold temperature records, but the rate at which we'll break warm temperature records will be something like 2 to 3 times the rate at which we break cold temperatures. So that is how global warming manifests itself. And we'll start to see changes in ecosystems, and that's beginning to occur. You'll start to see, you know, I look as somebody who grew up in Victoria, I see what I can grow here now versus what we could grow when I was younger. You know, my peach season has already happened. I picked all my peaches. That was in July. Like, who picks peaches in July in Victoria? Well, we do this year. You know, the grapes are growing. We got, so you're starting to see the ecosystems respond. Some will flourish, but many will not. Our cedar trees, for example, you'll start to see them dry out. And you'll see, as this plays out, more and more species suffering and become committed to extinction as they are unable to adapt, as opposed to humans who are a little more able to adapt, because we can put on warm, we can put on sweaters or turn on the air conditioning. You can't do that if you're a tree or a critter or the ocean water.
In a recent radio interview, Dr. James Hansen said that aiming for a 2 degree C level of warming as safe is not safe at all, given the climate sensitivity we've seen so far and new calculations on the speed of polar ice melt. What do you think?
I have no evidence to suggest he's wrong. So ultimately, whatever we choose is a value judgment. So there is no scientific reason to say 2 degrees is what we should limit it to. There is no scientific reason to say 1.5 degrees or 4. What we can say is, if 2 degrees, then this; if 1.5, then that. You know, I suspect if you're in the Maldives, a low-lying nation, you would even think that 1.5 degrees is too much, because the sea level rise committed from that sort of level of warming is substantive, and it's substantive particularly in relation to the existence of your nation if you're Maldives, because you have so much low-lying land. So it depends where you are. If you're in, say, you know, northern Alberta, well, what a little bit of warming may be a good thing for you. And 2 degrees might be good, because that'll manifest itself as 4, 5, 6 where you are there. So it really is a value judgment. It depends where you are. I like to think collectively. Collectively, I would say that Mr. Hansen actually is someone that I have a lot of respect for. So, you know, I would say I have no evidence to disagree with what he said. I would just caution the kind of hopelessness that comes with statements like that, I think, is unwarranted, because we can limit anything we want simply by getting a move on now.
Is there current scientific work that really interests you these days?
In the area of climate science, I don't know that we need more climate science to say what the problem is and what needs to be done. We do need more in terms of understanding the ability to adapt. We need more understanding of how the climate science will manifest itself on regional scales and play out in various sectors within our economy and within these various ecosystems, understanding how climate change will affect them. So in my area, I find it difficult to think of me going back and writing papers about permafrost carbon release in the years ahead. The type of science that interests me now is, and it always has, science in service of society. That is, science that can be used to help society. So I will probably be more of a science, rather than a science doer in the years ahead, I'll be a science policy doer. So I'm more interested in enabling others to do science and using science to inform policy these days than I am to actually do the science itself.
Listeners, our guest, Dr. Andrew Weaver, has been featured in the film Running on Climate. As a Canadian climate expert, Andrew has been a cornerstone of a series of reports from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's published over 200 scientific papers of his own. Now he's the first Green member of the Legislative Assembly in the Western Canadian province of British Columbia. You can find more links to all this and the topics we've covered today in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Andrew Weaver, thank you so much for your time and your insight.
Thank you very much for having me.
So maybe, just maybe, if we find the last wave of human will, we can avoid the coming catastrophe. Despite the tsunami of warning signs coming our way, I remain, as South Africa's Desmond Tutu says, a prisoner of hope. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock this week and for caring about our world.